dance around the kitchen at the teapot and the breakfast cereal and the milky bowl on the pine table. I have to tell him. I have to beg him to forgive me. We both love Rory. Neither of us wants to lose him. It can be our secret. I begin talking, but my mind doesn't work because I've barely slept. What if he disagrees? What if he calls the police? I'm worried about Rory, I say. He's not feeding. He's hardly had anything since yesterday. Hayden doesn't hesitate. His questions can wait. He goes to the bedroom where Rory is lying on our bed, wedged between two pillows. His legs are forced apart by the size of his nappy, and his weight loss looks even more severe. Hayden touches his forehead. He's on fire. But feel his hands and feet. They're cold. Wake up, baby, he says, gently shaking Rory. His eyes flicker. Hayden picks him up. Rory sags in his hands, his head rolling to one side. He's got all floppy. He's just tired. No, he needs a doctor. Or I could give him some more Calpol. How much did he have to eat yesterday? I give him what he wants. Sometimes he falls asleep before he finishes. What's the name of your new GP? Let's wait a little longer. No, I want you to call the doctor. My mobile is on the kitchen table. I scroll through the contacts list and pretend to call a number. Is that Dr. Niebel's surgery? I say, talking to nobody. This is Agatha Feifel. Yes, that's right. Merry Christmas to you too. I had the baby a few weeks ago and he's running a temperature. Hayden whispers loudly. Tell him it's serious. I cover the phone. I'm talking to his receptionist. You're making it sound like nothing. I go back to the fake call. He's off his food and slept badly. Yes, I've done that. Every 4 hours. I see. So you have nothing until then? Okay, put him down. His name is Rory Feifel. No, I mean Rory Cole. He's 16 days old. When? Asks Hayden as I hang up. Tomorrow. What? It's the first available. That's too long. Hayden picks up his phone. What are you doing? Calling Mum. She'll know what to do. No, he'll be fine. I grab at his arm. He shrugs me away. I don't care what you've done, Aggie, but Rory is sick. We're not going to wait. 10 minutes later, we're dressing Rory in socks, mittens and a woolen hat. Mrs. Cole called her GP and managed to get us an appointment. I know the risks, but Hayden refuses to do nothing. He carries the pram downstairs and pushes it ahead of me. Come on, come on! I'm hurrying! The doctor's surgery is in Brent Cross on the Northern Line. We have to catch 3 different trains to get there. As we wait on the platform, I keep checking Rory, praying for him to spark up or cry or do something energetic. Instead, he looks sluggish and barely conscious. I offer him a sip of boiled water in a bottle, but it dribbles down his chin. I have to prepare myself. I have to be confident. The doctor's going to ask questions. I need to have the answers tripping off my tongue as though everything is normal. I'm a new mother with a sick baby. Breathe. Relax. I can do this. Mrs. Cole fusses over Rory when we arrive at the surgery. Her whole demeanour changes around him. She lights up. Having a grandchild seems to have given her energy and dynamism, as though she's fulfilling her destiny. The waiting room looks like a United Colours of Benetton advertisement. Indians, Pakistanis, Africans. An Ethiopian woman has a toddler clinging to her colourful dress. She can't speak English. I envy her. I wish I could pretend to be foreign and not understand the questions. I'm asked to fill out a form detailing my medical history. Where was Rory born? The receptionist asks. In Leeds. Did you bring along his personal health record? I left it at home, sorry. What's the name of your health visitor? I make up a name. Is her number in your phone? No, she gave me her card. I stuck it on the fridge. I'm sorry, I'm not being very helpful. I can't think straight at the moment. I summon tears. The receptionist tells me not to worry. We can complete the form later. Are you breastfeeding? She asks. I did for a while, but I struggled. But are you still lactating? Ah, yes. What was Rory's birth weight? 6 pounds and 3 ounces. Was it a vaginal delivery? Yes, Any problems? No. Each new lie seems to wrap me in another cable that gets tighter around my chest. The creature inside me twists and turns, calling me names, hissing at me to run. I go back to my chair and wait. 10 minutes later, we're summoned inside. You don't have to stay, I tell Mrs. Cole, but it sounds ungrateful. I mean, I don't want to keep you if you're busy. I'm not busy, she says. I've brought my knitting. She holds up a tiny, half-finished cardigan threaded on her needles. Dr. Shaw is in his 60s, with a full head of grey hair sculpted into a wave that looks almost aerodynamic. He's particularly pleased to see Hayden.
The amount of times I stitched you up, I didn't think you'd survive this long, he says, laughing. Put the little fellow up here, he says, pointing to the examination table, and get him undressed.
For the next few minutes, he says nothing as he does the usual checks. Eyes, ears, nose, heart and lungs. He takes each of Rory's little limbs and bends them back and forth. He rotates his hips. He looks in his mouth. He feels his skull.
He's very dehydrated. Has he been vomiting?
No, I've been giving him boiled water.
Are you breastfeeding?
Not all the time. My health visitor told me I should put him on the bottle for a few days, and he seemed to take to it.
But you're still lactating. I half nod. We have a nurse here who's very good with breastfeeding problems, but I'm more concerned about his weight and his persistent fever.
I've been giving him paracetamol, I say.
For how long? Asks Dr. Schur.
Since yesterday morning, every 4 hours. The doctor continues to examine Rory, turning his arms and legs, looking at his elbows and behind his knees.
Purely as a precaution, I want you to take Rory to hospital, he says.
Why?
I hear the panic in my voice. It's extremely unlikely, but I tend to err on the side of caution.
What's unlikely? Asks Hayden.
Meningitis is very rare, particularly in babies who are only a few weeks old. But he does have a fever and a rash on the inside of his right thigh, which are some of the symptoms. I want to start him on broad-spectrum antibiotics immediately, just in case. But the hospital can test him properly. I'll phone ahead. You won't have to wait.
Dr. Shaw goes to his desk and types on his computer, humming to himself. He unlocks a cabinet and takes out several sealed packets of medicine, making a note of the serial numbers. He administers the first dose to Rory.
You can get him dressed, he says to Hayden before turning to me. Now you, young lady, how about I check you out?
I step away.
No, I want to make sure your uterus has shrunk back into your pelvis.
I'm fine.
Are you getting any contractions or afterpains?
No. Hayden has stopped dressing Rory and is staring at me.
Just pop off your trousers and sit up on the table. It'll only take a few minutes.
He knows. He knows. I don't want you looking down there. It's not you. I have a problem with male doctors. Something happened when I was young. I only let women doctors touch me.
I can get Nurse Hazelwood to come in. She can examine you and talk about the breastfeeding. He knows. He knows.
No, thank you, I say, pulling my coat around me. You've been very helpful, but I don't want to be examined.
Dr. Shaw looks at the form I filled out earlier. You haven't given us the name of your health visitor.
I left her card at home.
Or your GP. What's her name?
I'm seeing her later.
He knows. He knows. Where do you have your baby?
In Leeds, I say, sounding annoyed. I told your receptionist. She wrote it down.
Where in Leeds?
My tongue seems to swell up, blocking my throat.
You're upset, Agatha. I think you should calm down.
I am calm.
If you sit, we can sort this out.
There's nothing to sort out. I'm leaving.
I pick up Rory and push past Hayden.
Dr. Shaw steps in front of the door.
We need to discuss this.
There's nothing to discuss. He touches my shoulder. The creature inside me is out, unchained, filling my throat.
Get your fucking hands off me.
I don't recognize the voice. It's as though an entirely different person, an imposter, has momentarily taken my place.
Dr. Shaw takes a half step back, and I reach the door.
It opens outward, and I keep moving through the waiting room. Mrs. Cole is on her feet.
Get away from me, bitch, or I'll cut your eyes out!
She reels backwards, her mouth gaping. Hayden is yelling at me to stop. I turn my head and see Dr. Shaw talking to the receptionist. She picks up the phone. I keep moving, running.
They know, they know, they know.
Megan. The bastard, the fucking bastard. Jack had an affair. He took another woman into our bed, into many beds, or on the floor, or sofa, or kitchen bench. I cannot help but picture him fucking Rhea Bowden in all those houses in South London with a for sale sign out front. It makes me feel physically sick. Every time I push the images away, they come back again. Of all the women he could have slept with, he chose a blousy, painted, bleached estate agent who looks like a cougar. She's older than I am. The fucking bastard. He's been calling constantly, leaving messages, which I delete without listening to. I tell my parents not to answer their phones. Later, I hear Jack knock on the door, and my father tells him to give her some space. Jack jams his shoe in the closing door, and my father raises his voice. I hate him. I hate him so much that I never want to see or speak to him again. That's what I tell myself, and that's what I believe. I am not hysterical. I am completely calm. I am rehearsing what I'm going to say when I tell him our marriage is over and I want a divorce. Jack will be numb. He will be distraught. He will beg for one more chance. At the same time, I'm torn between anger and relief, loving and hating, a perilous dichotomy, because I am not innocent. I slept with Simon, a one-night stand that will always stand. 5 minutes of drunken passion, a moment of weakness, my act of infidelity. Jack has been seeing Rhea Bowden for months. Surely his betrayal is bigger than mine. Worse. The newspapers say the affair ended after someone shoved a note beneath the wiper blades on Jack's car, warning him to stop fooling around. Clearly one person knew that he was married. It could have been one of my girlfriends. I cringe at that thought. My friends are notorious gossips, incapable of keeping a confidence, particularly a scandalous piece of news like this one. One would have told the others, who would have passed it on, until everyone in Barnes knew except me. How they must have whispered behind my back, pointing me out and smiling conspiratorially. Real friends tell each other. Real friends help you bury bodies. Real friends bring their own shovel and don't ask questions. Maybe I deserve this, but I didn't mean to sleep with Simon or get pregnant again. Jack made a conscious choice to cheat on me. The stupid, weak, pathetic bastard deserves to be lonely. These are the thoughts that keep bouncing around my head as though I'm forewoman of a jury, considering the evidence, trying to reach a verdict. I'm alone in my childhood bedroom, which has been redecorated since those days. But I remember which posters once covered the walls, and where I positioned my bed so I could lay awake at night, looking at the rooftops on the far side of the road. I had a desk in the corner, which had a secret shelf behind the second drawer, where I used to hide my cigarettes and my first joint, which I was too scared to smoke. My mind drifts forward. I remember falling pregnant with Lucy. How excited Jack and I were. How we spent long hours talking about all the things we were going to do. On the night before she was born, she was 10 days overdue, we shared a curry and made love to see if we could bring on my labour. After she was born, I slept for hours. I remember waking up and seeing Jack holding Lucy in his arms, staring at this perfect little model of a person we'd just made. He'd taken her to the window of my private room and was pointing things out. "That's a double-decker bus," he said. "I'll take you on a bus one day. You'll love London." Next, I remember when Jack's father died. We went to the hospice and sat beside his bed and watched the end approach with each breath.
That was the day I realized that life is a series of goodbyes, and I had to make sure that I didn't waste my days or use them up too soon. 2 nights ago, Jack delivered a speech in the church that had me in tears. He said he loved me and that I made him stronger. I must believe that's still true. I'm angry with him. I want to punish him. I want to pinch his skin until he yells. I want him to know what he's done. But I don't want to say goodbye. I don't want to lose him. The doorbell chimes. My father answers, and I hear his footsteps on the stairs. A gentle knock.
"The police are here," he says, his voice full of concern. "They've been trying to call you."
DCS McAteer is standing in the hallway alongside Cyrus Haven. They haven't bothered taking off their overcoats. My heart skips. McAteer suggests I sit down. "No, tell me."
"There's been a development," he says. "We may know the identity of the kidnapper."
"Is it Rhea Bowden? Has she been arrested? I hope they marched her into the station in front of the cameras. Where's Ben?" McAteer asks.
"Do you know a woman by the name of Agatha Fifel?"
"What? Yes." He begins explaining, but I interrupt. "It can't be Agatha. She had her baby before me." Neither man responds.
"How did you meet her?" asks the detective.
"She worked at a local supermarket, the one opposite the green. We did yoga classes."
"She was pregnant?"
"Yes."
"Did she ever come to your house?"
"Once. I gave her some baby clothes."
"Could she have been faking her pregnancy?"
asks Cyrus. "No. She had her baby before me. I saw the photographs."
"Do you still have them?" asks McAteer.
"They're on my phone." I scroll through my emails and show them the images of Agatha holding her baby. Cyrus studies them closely.
"These could have been taken anywhere."
"She had a home birth," I say.
"These could have been staged," says McAteer.
"How? She's holding a baby."
"Her upstairs neighbor gave birth a month ago. She had a baby girl."
I shake my head, trying to think clearly. Agatha came to my house. Both of us got drenched in the rain. She used my bathroom, borrowed my clothes. I didn't see her get undressed. McAteer continues.
"Agatha Fifel visited a doctor in North London this morning. She didn't have any of the relevant paperwork for her baby, and couldn't give the doctor the details of her health visitor or her midwife."
"She said her mother was with her."
"Agatha's mother has been in Spain since early October," says Cyrus. "I spoke to her an hour ago. The first she knew of Agatha's baby was when she spoke to her daughter's fiancé, Hayden Cole, a week ago."
"How could her mother not know?"
I go back over the details.
"Agatha came to the candlelit vigil. She had a baby with her. I touched his head. Surely I would have known if it was Ben. I would have recognized him." In the same breath, I hear myself saying, "You have to arrest her."
"We have to be certain," says McAteer.
"But if you arrest her, she'll have to bring the baby. You can do a DNA test."
"Not without a warrant. We need proof."
My voice rises in fear. "You said she took him to a doctor. Is he sick?"
"He was running a temperature," says Cyrus. "The GP put him on antibiotics and recommended further tests. Agatha fled before he could raise the alarm."
"How sick? What's wrong with him?"
"There is a small chance that he has meningitis."
I raise my fist to my mouth and bite down hard on the knuckles, wanting to draw blood.
"We're watching Agatha's flat," says McAteer. "If she comes home, we'll interview her."
"What if she doesn't go home?"
"We are watching the train stations, airports, and ferry terminals, as well as contacting friends or acquaintances who might put her up."
"What about her mother's house in Leeds?" Cyrus asks.
"That too," says McAteer.
"Ben won't survive outside on a night like tonight," I say.
"I'm aware of that, but if we broadcast Agatha's name and photograph, we risk putting Ben in even greater danger. Remember our strategy. We have to keep her calm."
"Fuck the strategy," I want to yell. "My baby is sick." Cyrus has more questions for me.
wanting details of how much Agatha revealed about herself. I know what he's doing, trying to determine her state of mind. He wants to know if Agatha is the sort of person who would panic under pressure. I don't know if I'm the best person to ask. I thought Agatha was a friend. I invited her into my house. I gave her baby clothes. We sat in my kitchen and talked about pregnancy and babies and the future. What sort of monster steals another woman's child? Agatha. They will be coming for us now. They will surround the flat and break down the front door, splintering wood and bending hinges. They will storm up the stairs and go from room to room searching for us. I should have known it would come to this. I should have taken Rory abroad when I had the chance, packed my things and smuggled him out past customs and immigration. I could have taken him to... where? I have no money or contacts or experience of being on the run. The creature is blaming me, listing my mistakes, my stupidity. I'm useless, pathetic. I have failed again. What did I expect? I'm going to lose it all. My baby, my fiancé, my freedom. I have no right to happiness. Like wealth or beauty, it is given to others, not to someone like me. Foolish, foolish, stupid girl. I glanced down at Rory, asleep in my arms, and my chest heaved with suppressed sobs. These past few weeks have been the happiest of my life. I have lived my dream. It was my turn, my time. I have been loved. I have been whole. I should have known it wouldn't last, but I will not cry, not here, not now. The cab ride from Brent Cross is slowed by traffic on the North Circular. I'm almost at Chiswick when I discover I only have 20 quid in my purse. The meter's gone past that already. Can you pull over just here? I ask the driver.
What about Fulham?
No, here'll be fine. I take out all my notes and coins, counting them, while the driver waits impatiently. I'm terribly sorry, but I don't have enough. I'm £5 short. I look at him, hopefully.
Have you been crying?
He asks. The words get stuck in my throat. He looks at my baby.
Give me 20. I don't want a shrapnel. We'll call it even.
The cab pulls away. I risk looking at my phone. Hayden has been calling, leaving voice and text messages. Maybe I should call him back. I could tell him the truth and ask for help. He loves Rory as much as I do. Together we could come up with a plan, escape, start again somewhere new. In the same instant, I remember that the police can trace mobile phones. I turn mine off and take out the SIM card, throwing it into the gutter. I'm standing at the side of Chiswick Roundabout, smelling exhaust fumes and watching the blur of traffic. Kew Bridge Station is just down the road. I can catch a train. Where? I can't go back to the flat. I have no credit or debit cards. I left them in Rory's changing bag, which was hanging on the back of his pram. I didn't think. I had no time. I hold my hand against Rory's forehead. His fever has broken, and he has more colour in his cheeks. I still have the antibiotics the doctor gave me. I can give him another dose in a few hours. How will I feed him? Change him? At the railway station I find a public phone box and call Hayden's number. He answers on the first ring.
Agatha, where are you? I've been worried sick.
Are you at the flat?
Yeah.
Are the police there?
Who? No.
Look out of the window.
What's going on? Where are you?
More urgently. Look out of the window!
Okay, okay. What am I looking for?
Can you see anyone?
No.
In the background, I hear the intercom buzzing.
Hold on, says Hayden.
Is it them? He doesn't answer, but I hear him talking to someone on the intercom.
She's not here. Who wants to know?
I don't hear the answer. By then, I've hung up. I glance around me, certain that I'm being watched. Trying not to make eye contact with anyone, I walk down the station steps to the platform. A uniformed transport officer is at the bottom of the stairs, reading a free newspaper, waiting for the train. A sports bag is nestled between his feet. He looks up from the paper and notices Rory in my arms. I keep walking to the far end of the platform and hide behind a painted concrete pillar. Opposite me, on the westbound platform, a workman is picking up rubbish with a clawed stick. He's listening to music from earbuds that dangle from beneath his dreadlocks. He could be part of a surveillance team. I glance further along the platform. Two Asian women are chatting. Neither of them looks my way. They wouldn't, would they? They deliberately avoid me. Rory whimpers. He's hungry. I have nothing for him except boiled water. Why couldn't they leave us alone? Why did they have to keep searching for baby Ben? They portrayed him as some sort of fairy tale infant stolen by wolves or left to perish in the wilderness. He was always safe, always loved. If they'd just let him go, we would have been fine, happy. I've tried not to think of a moment like this. Failure has shadowed me, but I refuse to look over my shoulder. I've been here before. It feels like I'm leaning out of a burning building, fearing the fall as much as the flames, knowing I cannot survive either, yet I must choose one. The creature whispers to me, telling me I've lost. He is a brutal beast, determined to undermine and demoralize, to never forgive or forget. What did I expect? I kill babies. I only have to touch them and they die. Chloe, Lizzie, Emily, Elijah, all dead because of me. Now I'll lose Rory. The next train is coming. How easy it would be to step out now. What is there to live for if they take Rory from me? I will not see colour or taste sweetness or feel warmth. I'll be nobody. I will be worse. My toes are on the edge of the platform. I rock forwards and back on my heels, hearing the rails vibrate, feeling the rushing air. You're a coward. I'm not a coward. Do it then. Images flash through my mind. My funeral. Who would be there? Nobody. Not after what I've done. Unless my mother shows up, dressed like a Spanish widow and wailing over the casket, beating at the polished lid with her bony fists. My life has been forgettable. But my death could make amends. It could shock and horrify. It will be written about. It will make the news. The train driver will never forget. Megan and Jack, they will all have nightmares, waking in a cold sweat with my name on their lips, my face in their heads. I rock back and forth, leaning out further each time. Look how easily Nicky died. He had no time to regret. Nothing flashed before his eyes except the train that crushed his body. My life could be over just as quickly. My pain, my doubts. Do it. Go now. What about Rory? Take him with you. He doesn't deserve that. You'll have him forever. How? He deserves more. Suicide is the ultimate act of selfishness. But surely it becomes more so if we take another life. It's like saying, I cannot handle this world, so I choose to die. But I cannot handle death, so I choose to take someone with me. How cowardly, how self-obsessed. A cry for help becomes a wicked act. Unforgivable. The grounds for eternal damnation. The platform trembles. A train horn blasts. I reel away, as though blown backwards by the noise, clutching Rory to my chest. The train brakes, slows, stops. The doors open. The transport officer is beside me. Are you all right? He asks.
I'm fine.
Did you fall?
No, thank you. It's nothing.
Your baby's crying.
He points to Rory, whose little face is a picture of misery, his features bunched up and reddened. I carry him onto the train. The transport officer takes a seat, watching me. I stay beside the doors, waiting for the beeping sound that signals they're going to close. At the last possible moment, I step back onto the platform and the doors shut behind me. The officer gets to his feet. He walks down the moving carriage, trying to keep me in view, but the train carries him away. Rory's gone quiet. He's watching me expectantly. It'll be dark soon. We need shelter, food. The supermarket. I know where Mr. Patel leaves the spare keys. I know the code for the alarm, unless he changed it after I left. The place closes at 9 o'clock. I'll be able to get nappies and formula. We can sleep there tonight, as long as we're gone by 6 in the morning. I sit on the metal bench and hold Rory on my lap. "We're going to be all right," I whisper, kissing his cheek. "Today was not ours, but there's always tomorrow." Megan. A dark-skinned Hawaiian girl in a coconut bikini and hula skirt jiggles back and forth on the dashboard. Jack stuck the doll there, thinking her funny in a retro-sexist way. But now she reminds me of Rhea Bowden, shimmying her hips and acting slutty. I hit the girl with the back of my hand. She bends and bounces back, shimmying even harder. "Is there anything you want to talk about?" asks Cyrus, who insisted that he drive. I don't answer. "I saw the newspapers."
"Everybody saw the newspapers. The whole world is laughing at me."
"They feel sorry for you."
"Even worse."
"Can I just say..."
"No, I don't want to talk about it."
We drive in silence, crossing Putney Bridge and turning into Lower Richmond Road. "I'll say one thing," says Cyrus, "then I'll shut up."
He pauses, as though expecting me to argue. I don't.
"I have cheated on someone. A one-night stand that meant nothing, but it cost me a relationship with a woman I cared deeply about."
"She wouldn't forgive you?"
"I couldn't make it up to her."
Pain is etched around his eyes. His voice drops.
"I tried to make her understand that resentment towards me was punishing both of us. It may not be fair that you forgive Jack, but forgiveness by its very nature isn't fair. Someone must make a greater sacrifice. Someone has to start."
"You're saying that it should be me. Why is it always the woman?"
"It's not, I promise you. I talked to Jack. He's devastated."
"Good."
"He thinks he's lost you."
"Even better."
I wrap my arms around my chest and look out the window. "Do you still love him?" asks Cyrus.
"That's not a fair question."
"You're right. I should ask if you can forgive him."
"How do I do that?"
"Talk to him. Let him explain."
I don't want to hear the details. I don't want to imagine him and Rhea Bowden together. I can't bear the thought of touching him after what he's done, where he's been. I want to cut his penis off.
Cyrus is still talking. "It's not easy. First, you have to look behind you at what you've shared. Then you look ahead. You focus on rebuilding, not blaming."
"Is that what happened to you?" I ask.
"Almost," he replies, searing the car into our street. "I didn't try hard enough."
Jack meets us in the hallway, unsure whether to hug me or stay back. He reaches for my bag. I turn my head at the last moment and press my lips against his, holding the back of his head. His body shudders and melts against mine. I can taste coffee on his lips.
"I'm sorry,"
he whispers. "I know."
"It will never happen again."
"No, it won't." I kiss him again, because I don't want to talk about Rhea Bowden or think about Simon Kidd. The fate of my marriage can wait. All my energy has to go into getting Ben back. After that, I will decide if I still want Jack. PC Sousa has been reassigned as our family liaison officer. She's in touch with McAteer, who is back at the station, commanding the task force. Agatha hasn't returned to her flat in Fulham, and her mobile phone stopped transmitting in Chiswick in West London shortly before 2 p.m. 20 minutes later, she used a payphone at Kew Bridge Station to call her fiancé, Hayden Cole, who has denied knowing anything about baby Ben or the abduction. He claims to have been duped by Agatha, who faked her pregnancy while he was away at sea.
Agatha's phone records and email accounts are being searched, looking for clues to where she might go. In the meantime, DCS McAteer has decided not to release her name or photograph in case he pushes her to do something desperate. I can understand the logic, but the maternal part of me wants to plaster her image on every lamppost and yell her name from the rooftops. The phone rings. Jack answers and puts McAteer on the speakerphone. The DCS sounds energized, as though the previous weeks have been a warm-up. Now we're into the main game.
We know Agatha Fifel travelled to Leeds by train on December 4th, but have found no evidence of her giving birth, he says, his voice sounding hollow and metallic through the speakerphone. At midday on December 6th, she caught a bus from central Leeds to London Victoria. CCTV footage shows her holding a baby carrier, but doesn't show an actual baby. According to her fiancé, she didn't spend that night at a flat in Fulham, which means she may have somewhere else to go, a friend's house or accommodation, perhaps a hostel or a hotel. This puts her in London before you went into hospital.
She called me that night, I say. She said she was in Leeds.
That was 7:55 p.m. Technicians have triangulated Agatha's mobile signal. The call came from London, somewhere quite close to you.
How close? Asks Cyrus.
Best estimate? The back garden.
Something seems to shake loose and drop into my stomach. I glance out the French doors and remember the conversation. I was in the kitchen, making a cup of tea. Agatha told me all about her baby and the birth. I pictured her in her mother's house in Leeds. But in reality, she was outside, looking at me through the glass doors. We both heard the same train.
Why us?
I whisper.
She couldn't have her own child, says the DCS. Her mother confirmed it.
But why us? I ask, louder this time. I only met her 2 months ago.
I think she saw you a lot earlier, says Cyrus. I suspect Agatha thought very carefully about what baby she wanted. It helped her to rationalize what she planned to do.
There is nothing rational about any of this, says Jack, who is scornful of giving Agatha any motive or justification.
She idolized you, says Cyrus. You are successful, wealthy, well-liked. You have 2 children already, a boy and a girl. Agatha would have seen you as having the ideal life.
If only she knew the truth.
McAteer's call has been interrupted. He apologizes and makes us wait while he's briefed. We can't hear the other side of his conversation.
Are you sure? How many? Okay, get forensics. I want the scene locked down and sealed off.
He comes back on the speakerphone, but I hear something new in his voice, an added gravity that makes me frightened.
Our technicians have been tracing Agatha Fifel's movements in the days leading up to the abduction. She travelled by train to Leeds on December the 4th and went to her mother's house. The following day, she woke early and travelled to the outskirts of the city, where she walked along a canal into the woods. The technicians have identified where she stopped by triangulating signals from her mobile phone. A team of police reached the location 20 minutes ago, a ruined farmhouse in a clearing above a weir. The detective hesitates. They discovered 3 stone cairns arranged around the clearing.
My hand flies to my mouth as my mind collapses inwards, like a house of cards accosted by an open door.
Graves, I whisper.
It's too early to speculate, says McAteer. Forensic teams are on their way.
She's taken other babies, I say, looking at Cyrus. You predicted this.
We shouldn't jump to conclusions.
My mouth has gone dry.
Is she going to kill Ben?
They may be miscarriages.
3 of them?
Christ, says Jack, leaning his head against the wall.
My mood has been swinging wildly between elation and despair. Suddenly, it plunges again. We must find her. We have to get Ben back. At the same time, I'm torn between 2 opposing desires. One part of me wants to force Agatha to run, giving her nowhere to hide. Another part of me knows that she needs to find somewhere warm and safe to shelter my baby for another night. I am trapped between these two thoughts, willing her onwards, yet hoping she fails. Agatha. December cold, I shiver through the last hour, hugging Rory tightly to my chest, keeping him warm. Crouching behind rubbish bins, I watch Mr. Patel lock up the supermarket and leave through the rear door, twirling his keys on his forefinger as he walks down the alleyway to his Mercedes. A dark-coloured cat streaks out from behind the bins, chasing something smaller and equally dark. I almost scream and drop Rory, whose eyes pop open. He doesn't cry. Such a good boy. I've given him another dose of antibiotics, squirting the medicine in the back of his mouth so he didn't cough it up. He's hungry, but I have nothing to feed him until I get inside. Keeping to the shadows, I reach the deadlocked door and lift a loose brick at the base of the wall. The key is attached to a plastic fob and is meant for whichever employee is tasked with opening up each morning. Feeling for the lock, I stab at it blindly, knowing that once inside, I will have about 20 seconds to get to the control panel and punch in the code to deactivate the alarm. The key slides into place and turns. The door opens, and I hear the first shrill pre-alarm beeps getting louder as I approach the panel. My hands are so cold I hit the wrong code. I cancel the attempt and try again. How long do I have left? 10 seconds? 5? Unless the code has been changed. I'm halfway through the sequence of numbers when sound explodes around me and the lights begin flashing, illuminating every aisle of the supermarket. I hit the last number. Enter. Silence. I must have woken half of Barnes. I look down an aisle through the front windows at the street beyond. A red bus passes. An elderly couple, out walking their dog, glance into the supermarket and keep going. Rory lets out a muffled sob from beneath my coat. I carry him inside and lock the door. The heating's gone off, but there's enough residual warmth in the supermarket to shrug off my coat. Lifting Rory out of the sling, I rock him back and forth, making shooshing sounds, telling him it's all right. He settles by sucking on my little finger. The aisles of the supermarket are lit by low-watt security lights, which give everything a yellow-green tinge. I'm going to be visible to anyone passing outside. I get changed into a smock left behind by one of the staff and move along the aisles, collecting nappies, wipes, baby powder, formula and bottles. It's not until I see the shelves full of crisps, biscuits and chocolate bars that I realize my own hunger. Using the staff kettle to boil water, I sterilize 2 bottles and make up formula, wedging a bottle in the freezer between the frozen peas and oven chips, trying to cool it down. I check on it every few minutes, testing the temperature. In the meantime, I clean and change Rory, checking for any signs of a rash. Dr. Shaw said he was underweight and malnourished, but that's not my fault. I've tried to feed him. I did everything they said in the books. Sitting on sacks of rice, I feed Rory, who finishes a whole bottle, sucking on air to get the last drops. I burp him against my shoulder, praying that the milk stays down. He doesn't fall asleep immediately. He watches me as I make another 2 bottles in case we have to leave in a hurry. I find a steak and mushroom pie in the freezer cabinet and use the microwave in the storeroom to thaw it out. I cook it up with a packet of frozen vegetables and serve my feast on a paper plate with plastic cutlery. Scanning the shelves, I find the most expensive bottle of red wine and open that as well, raising a glass to Mr. Patel and toasting his generosity. "This is the life, isn't it?" I say to Rory, who watches me eat. "Wouldn't it be nice to stay here forever?" I know that's impossible. At 6 in the morning, someone will show up to open the supermarket, and the deliveries will begin, the bread and milk and newspapers. At 6:30, the doors will open, and the early risers will drift in, picking up supplies on their way to work. "I feel like something sweet," I say to Rory, whose eyes are growing heavy. I walk to the freezer chest and open the sliding lid, perusing the premium tubs of ice cream. "Will it be Ben and Jerry's, Haagen-Dazs, or Besant and Drury's?" "Why not try them all?" I start with 3 tubs, tasting each one. I'm opening a fourth when someone knocks on the front doors. A young couple, teenagers, are signalling me. They're both drunk and holding each other up.
"We're closed," I yell.
"We need cigarettes,"
says the boy, waving a 20-quid note.
"Try the pub."
"They kicked us out."
"Not my problem."
The girl twists up her face.
"Damn, it's such a cow. You can open for 1 minute."
"Can't do it. Register's closed."
The boy slams his hand against the doors, making them vibrate. He does it again, and I have to warn him that I'll call the police. He steps back and looks around until he spies a plastic milk crate. Picking it up, he hurls it against the glass, but it bounces off and hits him in the shin. It must hurt because he's hopping around. His girlfriend kicks at the door.
"I'm calling the police,"
I say, holding up my phone.
"Fat cow,"
she replies. The girl drags her boyfriend away, weaving across the road to the bus stop, flipping the V's at a passing driver who toots his horn. Pouring another glass of wine, I glance at the magazine covers, featuring beautiful women with airbrushed bodies and celebrity couples with varnished lives who will grow old gracelessly and cling to fame. One of them shows a woman in a bikini and sarong on a white sand beach where the azure water matches her eyes. A little boy is playing with a bucket and spade at her feet. I once asked Hayden if he would take me to Tahiti, but he laughed and said I'd get seasick. That was before Rory. I want to go home. I want to sleep in my bed. I want Hayden's arms around me and to hear him say that he loves me. We were so happy together. We could have been a great couple, envied by others like Jack and Megan. Not perfect. I realize that now, but worth preserving. A marriage should have children. It's hard enough to keep one together even with a child. Without them, I don't know if it's possible. I saw that with Nicky, how the joy and spontaneity and laughter went out of our marriage when he was forced to wank into a cup while I was prodded, poked, and inseminated with my legs in stirrups and a stranger's hands touching me. Rory's asleep. I run my finger down his cheek and across his parted lips, knowing how little time we have left. There's nowhere we can hide. I don't have the money or the anonymity. I don't have the energy. Curling up on the floor next to Rory, using my coat as a blanket, I try to sleep and dream of Tahiti, the warm water and soft breeze, and my little boy playing in the sand. Everything scares me. The traffic outside, the creaking of the roof, and the silence. The creature has won. He knows that. He is feasting on my inner organs, enjoying his last supper. Megan. Trapped between wakefulness and terrible dreams, I toss and turn, occasionally opening my eyes, hoping for morning to appear beyond the window. The curtains remain dark, and the city sleeps. At some point, I get out of bed and walk through the quiet house. Jack is sleeping in an undersized bed in the newly decorated nursery.
"Are you awake?"
I whisper.
"Uh-huh,"
Jack says, mumbling into his pillow. I sit next to him, the bed sags.
"What are you thinking about?"
"Same as you.
Do you think he's all right?"
"I hope so."
The curtains are open, and the branches cast shadows on the wall.
"Are you sure we can survive this?"
I ask.
"Maybe we're not meant to stay together."
"Don't say that."
"Why did you sleep with Rhea Bowden?"
"Because I am monumentally stupid."
That's not an answer. He takes a deep breath. I feel his chest expand and contract.
"I wish I could tell you."
"I can make it a multiple-choice question. Was it a midlife crisis? Boredom? Did you stop loving me?"
"No, no, never that."
"She's not younger than me. She's not prettier." My voice is growing strident. "Explain it to me."
"She was there,"
he whispers.
"What?"
"Rhea Bowden. She was there."
Mount Everest is there. You could have mounted that.
I don't love her. I never did.
Oh, so it was just sex.
My sarcasm stings him. He shifts uncomfortably. I catch the scent of his deodorant and the warm fug of his body.
I'm giving you a chance to explain.
He turns to face me, propping his head on his hand.
It was exciting at first. Frightening.
Different.
You and I had stopped talking to each other.
We talk all the time.
We talk about bills and expenses and kids, but not about each other. We don't share our intimate thoughts anymore. We don't talk about the future or laugh about the past. I used to believe that life was leading somewhere, but it's not, is it? This is it. We're simply existing.
And Rhea Bowden changed that?
No. I thought she might, but I was being stupid.
He reaches across the bedspread and touches my hand. I pull it away.
Every time I think of you with that woman,
don't then.
How do we get beyond this?
We start again. We do it for Lucy and Lachlan and Ben. We owe it to them.
He reaches for my hand. I let him take it.
Every word I said at that church was true. I think you're truly remarkable, and whatever happens, whether we're together or apart, I will always love you.
I pull back the covers and slide onto the narrow bed next to him. His arms close around me and we spoon as though trying to mould our bodies into one.
This doesn't mean you're forgiven.
I know.
I notice a suitcase on the floor and a pile of Jack's clothes.
Are you leaving me?
I didn't know if you wanted me to stay.
I thought maybe you'd already gone.
No.
Are you sure?
Positive.
Agatha. I wake with a start, frightened that I might have overslept. The clock on the microwave says 5:14. I touch Rory's forehead. He doesn't stir. The fever has gone. Getting stiffly to my feet, I put on my coat and warm a bottle in the microwave. Rory's mouth opens at the touch of the teat, and he sucks automatically, taking the whole bottle. I change his nappy again and pack a few spares. The clock says 5:40. I have another 15 minutes. Mr. Patel's secret place is a drawer beneath the cash register. It's where he stores the mobile SIM cards and lottery scratch cards and the cash float for the registers. He keeps a spare key in the broom cupboard so that whoever opens up each morning has cash for the register. Unlocking the drawer, I take a handful of SIM cards and the bundle of banknotes, leaving the coins behind. Reaching further into the drawer, my fingers search for something heavy, wrapped in an oily cloth. The gun. The one Mr. Patel boasts about and shows to new employees, hoping to impress them. The gun he doesn't like to use. My fingers close around the handle. I draw it out, unwrapping the cloth, weighing the pistol in my hand. I spend a few moments identifying the safety catch and how to remove the magazine. The knot inside my chest seems to loosen. I have options now. I won't be bullied or rushed. I will decide how this ends. Tucking the pistol into my bag, I cover it with nappies and wet wipes and two bottles of formula. The clock says 5:55. Time to go.
Where?
Away from here.
Foolish, foolish.
Shut up.
You could have ended this yesterday if you weren't such a coward.
I have a plan.
Tahiti, is that your plan? Foolish girl.
Slipping Rory into the sling, I adjust the knot, securing him snugly against my chest, then button my coat around him. I lead through the rear door, along the lane, passing Lucy's school, before cutting across the edge of Barnes Common to the railway station. I buy a coffee from a man with a van who wears fingerless gloves and sells homemade muffins. He banters, chirpy for the hour, but I'm not in the mood for small talk. Bundles of free newspapers are stacked beside the station entrance. I look at the front page and find no mention of baby Ben or of me. I look at pages 2 and 3. Nothing. I expected my picture to be all over the papers by now,
the woman who stole baby Ben. Instead, they're still fixated on Rhea Bowden and her affair with Jack. Poor Meg. It's bad enough being cheated on without it becoming public. I blame Hayden. He must have thought he was so clever selling that story to the papers. But all he's done is to jeopardize a marriage. You should hate her. Why? She has what you want. She's rubbing your nose in it. That's not her fault. Fuck her up. Show her how it feels. What feels? Losing someone you love. Waiting on the eastbound platform, I'm joined by a handful of early morning commuters, breathing in clouds and stamping their feet against the cold. The train rounds a distant bend, appearing from the mist and slowing to a halt. The doors open. I take a seat in a quiet corner before retrieving my phone and inserting a new SIM card. Hayden will probably be asleep or under arrest, or both. Whatever the case, they'll be listening to his calls. He answers groggily. It's me, I say.
Aggie?
Yeah. There's a long pause. He's covered the phone as though he's talking to someone. Another voice comes onto the line.
Agatha, this is Brendan McAteer of the Metropolitan Police.
I want to speak to Hayden.
You can speak to him, but first I have to ask if baby Ben is with you, and if he's all right.
The question irritates me. Why is he asking about Ben? It's always been about Ben, never about Rory. I want to scream at him. How dare he ignore my child? Put Hayden on, I say through gritted teeth.
Listen to me, Agatha. I know you're scared, but I can help you. We all want to see that nobody gets hurt.
Put Hayden on the phone right now, or I'm going to hang up. I won't be calling back. You have 3 seconds.
Agatha, please listen to me.
2 seconds.
I want to help you.
1.
Here's Hayden.
The phone is handed over.
It's me again, he says.
I hear someone in the background mentioning the word train. They'll be looking for me. My voice falters. I guess you've worked it out by now.
A while ago.
I'm sorry that Rory isn't your baby.
That doesn't matter now.
How is Rory? Does he still have a fever? No, he's better.
He could have meningitis.
I don't think so. He's hungry again.
That's good.
Someone in the background is feeding Hayden lines, trying to keep me talking while they search.
What about you? Hayden asks.
I'm okay. Tears are splintering my vision, and my nose has started to run. I didn't mean to trick you. I thought that if you spent time with me and Rory, you might fall in love with both of us.
You were right,
Hayden says, his voice breaking.
When you first told me you were pregnant, I didn't want to be a father. I wasn't ready. Even when I came home for the birth, I told myself that I wouldn't change my mind. But I was wrong. From the moment I set eyes on Rory, I knew my life would never be the same.
Do you mean that?
Uh-huh. There's something I haven't told you. It was going to be my Christmas present to you. I wrote to the Navy last week and resigned my commission. I planned to get a job closer to home, nearer to you and Rory.
I'm sorry, I sob, feeling even more miserable. Glancing out the window at the factories and warehouses, I picture the police trying to find me. How long will it take to trace the call? Do they have satellites trained on me now? You see that in all the spy films, satellite cameras that can zoom down and pick out a car number plate or a face in a crowd. The train's pulling into Clapham Junction. There are no police on the platform. Did you tell the papers about Jack and Rhea Bowden? I ask.
No, I swear. She must have sold the story herself, says Hayden.
I want to believe him.
Give yourself up, Aggie. Tell us where you are. I'll come and get you.
I can't do that.
Rory isn't ours.
I know.
What are you going to do?
I'll give him to Megan, I whisper, wiping my nose on my sleeve. Hayden doesn't answer straight away. I know the police are listening. Tell them I'll give the baby to Megan, nobody else, understand?
I don't think they'll go for that idea.
Remember that place you took me to on our first weekend together?
You wanted me to learn things about the Navy.
Yeah.
That's the place.
What time?
This morning. I don't know what time. Remember what I said. It has to be Megan, not the police. Tell them I have